Good morning. If you've been with us, we have been in Matthew. We've been talking about the parables. Parables in Matthew, there has been a theme. The theme is up on the slide right now, which Matt hit on last week, the king and his kingdom. Keep in mind the two types of kingdoms, God's kingdom, Satan's kingdom. We have been kind of rerunning these over the past weeks. However, we have, you know, sometimes you might be serving in one of the children's classrooms and you haven't been in here, or perhaps you weren't here, because like this morning I think we have three elders that are out doing family things, and so you weren't here. So it's good to be reminded of these. I'm not going to read down through them. I would point out probably for this morning and our passage today, and I almost hesitate to do it, but I'm going to do it, is the number three, the two pieces, Satan's kingdom dividing, God's kingdom gathering. You maybe have already experienced that theme this morning as we've made the change with where we're sitting. Matt talked last week about the purpose. This is important to keep in front of us because when we approach Scripture, understanding background, understanding context, understanding story, and it's his story, it's God's story, and that the purpose of Matthew is to convince the Jewish audience that Jesus is the Messiah. And to recap, last week, Pastor Matt, there he is, was talking about a parable in Matthew 22, 1-14. He talked about the wedding feast and picking out just a couple of key points from that. You can see those up on the slide. I will do my best to just kind of paraphrase them. The wedding feast was the parable. What Matt talked about was with the wedding feast, the guests coming, that there is clothing that is provided. There is a new clothing. And for us to wrestle with the question, are we going to take on that new clothing and be changed? Or are we just going to settle and with that clothing that might be comfortable and just stay the same, unchanged? And to contrast that with a couple weeks ago when I was in Matthew 21 and I think verse 45, and that should be up on the screen, where the Pharisees heard the truth. They recognized the truth, yet they were unwilling to allow the truth to change them. And that was recap from last week with Pastor Matt. So today we're in Matthew 22, 34 to 46. I want to say a couple of things. In the outset, you might notice a gap. Pastor Matt ended with verse 14. I am picking up with verse 34. That's 20 verses that aren't covered. Don't sweat it. We have Bibles out on the bar out there if you need one before you go. If you have one, I encourage you to open yours up at some point and check out those 20 verses. We'll at least give you a paraphrase of what's going on. What's important to keep in mind is that this is not a parable today. What this is this is an interaction. Okay, this is an interaction between Jesus and, again, the Pharisees. And this is on the heels of a couple of different Jewish sects, S-E-C-T-S, groups that have tried to stump Jesus. They've tried to test Jesus, and really what it comes down to is they're trying to defame him. They're trying to see if they can basically make him look bad. And so the Herodians, they tried to do it with challenging him on the taxes, and do we pay taxes? You can read about that in the verses. And next, the Sadducees, they tried to do it with the woman who married the seventh brother and what happens in heaven with the first husband that was the first brother. You know, something like that, paraphrasing, and that's probably a near terrible paraphrase. But you can read it, find out about it, that the Sadducees were challenging him on the resurrection. So each one of these attempts to stump Jesus, to make him look bad, ends with the Herodians and the Sadducees looking foolish, and in fact confused, and they said it themselves, like, hey, we just don't get this. So, and I think I said there, in effect, they were shut down. So, this morning, taking a look at the passage that I have, starting in verse 34, what I want to do is walk us through, real quickly, some comparisons for us to understand a little bit about who the Pharisees and who the Sadducees are. So on the screen, you can see, and I might round out these points just a little bit because I tried to keep it single, you know, single column to fit as much on as I could. So who are the Sadducees? Who is this group? Well, it's important to understand when Jesus is talking with the Pharisees, because in verse 34, the Pharisees are responding to Jesus' interaction with the Sadducees. So who are they? They were wealthy. They were the aristocrats, the upper class, the upper echelon, and they most of them held powerful positions in Israel. Second, they're the ruling majority of the Sanhedrin. Well, who's the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin is the ruling council of Israel in the day, and it's comprised of Sadducees and Pharisees, but the Sadducees had the majority. And the Sadducees were concerned more with politics than religion. This is not up there, but this is important to know. The Sadducees were more concerned about Rome. And a lot of times when we think back to Scripture and we think about Rome and what Rome symbolizes, well, Rome symbolizes the world, worldliness. And the Sadducees were way more concerned about keeping the peace. They want to keep the peace with Rome. So they're way more interested in the politics. They oversaw the sacrifices at the temple, so they did have, in fact, Levitical heritage, the priestly heritage. That's where these guys came from, and they oversaw the sacrifices. And the reason they oversaw them, the reason the sacrifices at the temple were important to them, is because in the Hebrew, that word translates close to God. And so this is what they saw as their doing thing to get close to God, is to sacrifice. They believed only in the written law. Well, what does that mean? That means the Mosaic books. So the first five, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. After that, no dice. That's all they believed in. And of course, we are in Jesus' time, so fast forward all the prophetic books, all those books that had come ever since. They don't believe in the oral tradition of the law, just the written. Couple of important things, especially in lining them up with the Pharisees and comparing them, is they don't believe in an afterlife. They don't believe in eternity. They don't believe in the resurrection. And they don't believe in a spiritual realm. So from demons to angels, they're not into that. They don't buy it. They don't believe it. They don't operate their lives out of the fact that they don't believe that truth. So the Pharisees. Who are the Pharisees? Well, the Pharisees, and we've been talking a little bit more about the Pharisees, so, and you might be more familiar with them. They related much more with the common man. So they, as far as the people of Israel, the Pharisees were the ones that the people even looked to because of that relationship that the Pharisees had. They identified with them much more than the Sadducees. And they were concerned way more with religion than they were with the politics. However, because the Sadducees, I think we could say they operated out of fear of man. The Sadducees would usually give way to the Pharisees because they knew if they didn't listen to the Pharisees that the people would be up in arms, and the Sadducees didn't want that, so they typically went with the Pharisees. Pharisees, brilliant thinkers, and you'll even find some modern-day rabbis who would say, and I'm sure many before believe, that the Pharisees greatly impacted Jewish religion. I mean, these guys, the Pharisees, they took care of, they, in a way, I would say, you know, kind of like moderated the whole law. And these guys were the ones who, you know, they managed that. And so very influential, very smart. They believed both the oral and the written. Interesting to know, and also probably for our passage, you're going to see where it plays in, is that in the law, there's 613 Mosaic laws, and so the Pharisees are, you know, they're watching over these 613 laws. And one last thing it's important to know is they're basically enemies of the Sadducees. And you might have known that, you might not have known that, you might have gathered that from checking out the two slides this morning. But it is important for the passage that we're in this morning to understand that the Pharisees didn't really care for the Sadducees. Okay. Why don't we stand up? typically, you know what, I'm having you stand up, and normally what we've done, if you've not been here, is we stand up for the reading of the Word. It's a way that we honor and recognize the Word as important. And then following the reading of the Word, usually who reads it would say, Word of the Lord, and we say, Praise be to God. So what we're going to do is we're going to practice the end of it, and I'm going to read it with you and walk through it. Okay? So, the Word of the Lord. You can have a seat. Thank you. I'm going to come down by Jake so everybody can see the slide, and I think I might do what Justin did, and I'm going to sit down with everybody this morning as we take a look at this, and we might do this in shotgun fashion. When the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, and this is the only thing I'm going to point out in this passage as far as a meaning behind the word. That word silenced means muzzled, and you think of a muzzle, I'm not saying you have to, but I usually think of a dog, and I think, well, why does somebody muzzle a dog? Usually because of a bark, it's intimidating, it's presenting a threat, and it might bite. So he muzzled them, silenced them. So when the Pharisees heard this, they gathered themselves together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him, that's Jesus, a question, testing him, Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? So stopping there at the question mark on law, a couple of things. The Pharisees, at this point, hear what the interaction is with Jesus, and instead of celebrating, they say, oh, the Sadducees didn't stop him. We got to figure something out here quick. Let's get together. So they call the lawyer, and in this case, we're not necessarily talking like Barry Naum lawyer, who is an energy lawyer. If you didn't know, you can get to know him more. He's sitting right over there. The lawyer here is a student and a teacher, an expert in the law. And we can know by, if you're interested, in looking in Mark chapter 12, we know that this lawyer that the Pharisees brought would probably be identified with the Pharisees, but was not coming most likely in the same motivation. The Pharisees, they wanted to destroy Jesus. They wanted to defame him. They wanted to make him look like an idiot. They were out to get him. The lawyer was coming with a good question and most likely a much healthier motivation than the Pharisees. And he says, Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus said to him, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and foremost commandment. The second is like it. So the second half of the first slide in our passage, which is through verse 39, is, and remember back to our slide with the Pharisees who kind of moderate those 613 laws. And we have this expert in the law who says, so which one is the greatest? And you can probably imagine why you might want to know that, because 613 laws are a lot of laws. for example, here's one of them. Don't rub corn cobs together on the Sabbath. I know. The interesting thing, though, is you've got to wonder here, both the lawyer and I'm guessing for sure the Pharisees, in not only trying to test Jesus, but to consider, how can we obey the law like, you know, have our cake and eat it too, like the easy way? Because if Jesus said, if you don't rub corn cobs together on the Sabbath, that is how you fulfill the law, like how much easier would that be? But what Jesus says, and you might recognize this as Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, is to love the Lord your God with all of yourself. That's probably another sermon. I was going to say something else, but I just said to be quiet. He says and summarizes all the law in this one piece of Old Testament, which is Deuteronomy 6, 5, to love God with all of yourself. And to imagine the Pharisees thinking in their response to this, yeah, well, and even yourself this morning, think about it. How do you wrap your hands around that? Because it's not the kind of thing where you can just not rub two corn cobs together. It's Jesus calling us to a greater truth. And he says the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then he says, on these two commandments depend the whole law and prophets, which is important because he is speaking there, of course, of the written and the oral law, which goes against the Sadducees and what they believe or don't believe. And so while the Pharisees are gathered together, Jesus says, well, I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? And for us in our language, in our day, we could be asked that same question, what do you think about the Christ? And our response would be probably pretty varied if we took a minute to talk about it with each other this morning. But what he's getting at, what Jesus is getting at is, where did he come from? What's his heritage? What's his line? That's what he's asking. It's not kind of a nebulous, arbitrary, you know, what do you think about Jesus? I think he's cool. I like his robe. He's got a great sandal maker. That's not what he's asking. He's asking, what's his lineage? What is his line? And so their response is, we would say, pretty safe and pretty right, right? I mean, if you know Scripture, you know that the story, the history, God's story, is that the Messiah, Christ, does come from the line of David. And so they answer, the son of David. And Jesus says to them, well, then how does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies beneath your feet. If David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? No one was able to answer him a word, nor did anyone dare from that day on to ask him another question. And what Jesus does in answering the Pharisees this question is he answers it with David's words. In Psalm 110, verse 1, and David is in the Spirit, and all in one time, David speaks about someone from his line in the present tense because they exist, and he speaks of them not as a son because, and we have this a little bit in our culture today, but much more in the culture of this day when Jesus is saying this, is you don't talk about your son in that way. You don't talk about someone coming from your line in a way that David talked about the Lord. In Psalm, where it says, the Lord said to my Lord, there are two Hebrew differences. The first Lord is Jehovah. The second Lord is a derivative of Adonai. And so David is speaking of God and of Christ before Christ is even born, and speaking of him with his authority and with his superior place. And what we have is Jesus' response to the Pharisees speaking again of this higher truth. He's calling us to a better truth. And he's calling the Pharisees to that better truth because he's not just saying, it's not just about Jesus coming from a human line. Yes, his human line from man is through David, but he is also divine. He comes through the Father. He comes through God. And so this is the word of the Lord. Praise be to God. I want to bring up this slide from last week, which is Matt's teaching, and Matt taught on a response from the wedding and from, well, that we could probably identify with as well. And the reason I'm bringing it up today is because the Pharisees and the Sadducees had a common response. The response being, well, I want to defend myself. The Sadducees, they've been on the scene, they've been taking care of sacrifices, and Jesus comes on the scene. And if you were here a couple of weeks ago and we talked about the cornerstone, well, that cornerstone was rejected because as the brick builder was building the house, it didn't fit. It didn't fit in shape, it didn't fit aesthetically, and there is a reject pile. And Jesus was cast into that pile. And so we have the Sadducees saying, here's this Jesus. He's starting to stir things up. And remember, they cared much more about politics than they cared about the religious law. And what their concern was is, oh man, this guy, this Jesus, cannot start causing a problem with Rome. we got to do something. So they try to, in front of the people, make him look like a fool. They try to defame him. So they want to defend themselves. Pharisees, same thing. Pharisees have been managing, taking care of the law for all these years. They've been on the scene. They have a reputation with the people. They've been teaching it. They've been leading in it. Here comes Jesus. He does not make sense. He does not fit. No one understands him. And he's threatening us because the people like him. And you can read that in verse 33. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. And this isn't the only account. You can find it in other accounts in the Gospels. So what's the response of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? They want to destroy. They want to destroy Jesus and the person bringing the truth. Well, they were having a tough time doing that because Jesus kept coming back with this better truth. They couldn't do it. And so what do? Well, they begin to deceive, and eventually they denounce the truth being Christ, and they kill him. And so you see these two groups, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and you'll have to forgive me because I've built slides, you know, to kind of help us or me, and I can't remember. Okay, it was the one I thought it was. When we think of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they're enemies, okay? But let's just, for a second, think about who they are. The Sadducees' heritage, they are Israel. They are God's kids. They were focused on sacrifice, except to the point where they saw sacrifice as salvation. Doing something is what's going to get me close to God. The Pharisees saw the religion and following the religion, and in fact the laws and the rituals becoming so much of their identity and who they are that it got in their way of their relationship. And so in asking the question, who are they? Who are the Pharisees? Who are the Sadducees? There's a lot of times where we can be sitting here and we can understand who the Pharisees and the Sadducees are, and we can look around and we can say, that's a Pharisee. That's a Sadducee. I don't know if you noticed I'm pointing. Okay? I haven't looked at myself yet, because when I hear the truth, I have an option. I have an opportunity. Is it going to change me? Am I going to put on the clothing? Am I going to be changed? And so often, we want to point out the Pharisees and we want to point out the Sadducees. And we fail to take that opportunity to look at ourselves. The next slide will confound even me, I'm sure. Anybody have a guess as to what that is? I hear murmurings. Don't be afraid. And somebody actually just went, I think. Was that you, Bob? I can only imagine. Anybody have a guess as to what you're looking at there? I know some of you will probably know what it is. Very good. It is a map of something, which is important. It is important, very important. Keep guessing. What else? It is a map of something. Somebody said Middle Earth and somebody said risk, and on both accounts they're true, but like Jesus, hopefully we are going to go to a better truth. I hope my head is not in the way. It might be for some of you. Before we talk about that, and I was given a Band-Aid this morning, but I could not function with a Band-Aid on this thing, so there we go. I want to share a story with everybody. And before I share the story, I want to encourage you all that you have written it, because the story is us. The story is Cornerstone. And the story has been It's been being written for years. And personally, as God has been giving and gifting me some things, has been impressed upon me in the last several weeks and months. And I want to share it with you this morning. The purpose of the map, and I think I've been told that when we try to use this laser, it's not seen very well from the back, so let me try it. Can everybody see the laser? It's right in the middle. Okay, I'm not using it right now. There are little figures on this map of Middle Earth. This is a snapshot taken last night at about 10-something of a risk board that I have that was gifted to me. If you have not played Risk, I would love to play with you, although you might not love to play with me. It is a thinking game. It is a game of strategy, and I also love the story of the Two Towers, the Fellowship of the Rings, and Return of the King. The figures on here, you will see there's green, represented by good forces today, and usually in the game too. And there's black, which would be represented by enemy forces. And you can see there's kind of a smattering here of where the forces are, and the entire picture could not be, which, you know, for our purposes today, it's kind of a bummer, but I can show you, if you're interested sometime, the bigger picture. But I'm going to the bottom left corner. You can see there's two green forces right here. There's a third one here. There's a fourth one right here. And on the wall right here, where you can hardly see the laser, there's many more of the green infantry or the green forces. If you follow the laser now, I'm on the left side, about in the middle, coming over. Okay, the enemy forces are kind of in here. There are some green forces that are separated over here. And moving down the board, which looks like we're moving across it because the board's turned on its side, there's this this grouping. And if you know anything about the story of the movie, this is kind of this area up here. So I'm at the top of the map, over more toward the right side of center. This is where everything culminates. That's kind of where the whole movie comes to a climax. And so the enemy in the movie actually owns this and is operating out of here. And the good forces down here moving ahead, enemy forces in between. The picture and what we're looking at today is not the bell, but it did remind me of something, and that is, okay, there it is. Anybody see that laser? Where did it go? We might have lost it. On the upper right screen, right of the screen, there's a single green infantry force. Back to the story. This is a picture of Cornerstone. And what I mean by that is that we have had, and some of you I realize might not even have been a part of this, but currently we're in a sabbatical. And it's something that as a church we've probably talked about in our groups, in places. It's mentioned, you know, from up here from time to time. Our lead pastor, Jay McCumber, his wife, Sherry, have been on sabbatical for a few months. We're actually on the back end of the sabbatical, which will culminate sometime in the end of December. And I want to encourage everybody with this, that you may or may not realize it, but I have definitely been encouraged with it, that God is speaking. And I can tell you that God is speaking to the McCumbers, and God is speaking, and they are us, so I don't want to confuse that. They're apart from us. They're withdrawn right now. He's also speaking with us while they're withdrawn and while we're withdrawn. We have had a leader in Jay who is a very strong leader, a very strong man in many senses, you know, physically, intellectually, spiritually speaking, this guy is strong. And he has very broad shoulders, both literally and metaphorically. And as a father, Jay, and kind of as the, or you could say shepherd for the analogy, it might work better. So Jay as a shepherd has carried the sheep, and we've moved, you know, we've advanced. And then God calls rest. And so we're put down as a flock, and the shepherd withdraws, and we're kind of left here in the field, the forest, wherever we might be, and kind of taking stock now of, okay, how did we get here? This is not a bad thing for any of us, because, and if you were here and you remember back, that the motivation for the sabbatical is for two main things. First, that Jay and Sherry receive from Jesus what they need from him, not from you and I. You know, not from a response or a reaction or, you know, good movements or even bad movements, but very much into the childlike son and daughter ship that they need. And the same thing for us as the body, as the flock, is that we are not trying to get from Jay what it is he can't give us, which we can't put that on him. We need to receive from him. So today, as I sit here with you and share the story and we look at this map, we have a couple of things we find ourselves in, and that is, as a church, what has been spoken of us is that we are a scout church, we are a lead church, a visionary church, prophetic, meaning what we see, what we speak is out. It's out front. It's out. I mean, even with other bodies of churches, that outside people, not just Cornerstone within us, that has been spoken over us. I believe that. I believe that to be true. I will look at all of you and tell you, I don't always know what that means. I know my gift set and my leanings are is that I need to trust people who can see, because I'm much more, you know, right here. Our lead scouts, our lead visionaries, prophetic, are out there. We have a main force, which would be in the lower left-hand side, and you can see the green infantry divisions building. There is a main body, a main force, main strength, and then there's our lead scouts that are out front. And where we find ourselves as a church is that we need to regroup, because the main force can't see and experience what's going on out front. And the out front scouts, they're not able to also experience and see what's going back on with the main body. And so as a family, we need to pull back together and we need to regroup. There are many things in our body right now, and if you're visiting with us today, if you wouldn't normally call this home, thank you for being here. Thanks for joining with our family, and if you're in the family of Christ, you're with us anyways. There are going to be common things that you might experience in your own family, wherever your family church is. There are many things going on in Cornerstone right now that in some respects could cause some of us to be very concerned for the future, the health of Cornerstone, and those things are true. I'm not going to be vague about them. I'm going to talk about a couple of them. At the same time, what I have heard is God is presenting these things as a huge opportunity to trust him. So, using the analogy of the board again, here at Cornerstone, this was first spoken that I heard it from an elder, and then it came to the elder meeting, so it was individually one-on-one, and if you notice here, this is biblical. This is how God instructs us to go to each other. The elder came to me and shared this with me, and then as elders, we shared it together. But what was really cool was that elder meeting, that it was shared. It was very natural. It just flowed. It wasn't like there was an agenda for this to be, you know, this is what we need to talk about. What this elder shared is that on the elder team, which God has shifted, so don't be confused, but also with Cornerstone, is that there are two voices, there's two languages, and I'm going to say there's two camps. And those two camps here at Cornerstone, they reveal themselves in different ways. And we could get stuck on things like art and beauty or creating, which is in one realm. And if I have time to talk about that, I hope I do, I will. We will be talking about this more if we don't get all of it today. There are other things such as freedoms, religious freedoms. Drinking would be one. Smoking might be another. Music could also be one of those freedoms, those religious freedoms. And what we see, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, and if I had a board, I would have written them all up there for you, is we want to get involved in all those things. What we want to do is we want to start arguing about the drinking. We want to start arguing about, and this is a different realm, the art, the artwork, and how art is incorporated here. However, and please be thinking about the links of today's passage, is we're missing each other. There is a greater call here. There is a better call. In our camps, what's happening is we have, in the realm of religious freedoms, we have people in the camp of religious freedoms who have legitimately experienced religious freedoms. I'll give you a couple of mine. No, I'll just give you one of mine. When I was younger, I used to listen to Metallica. I used to listen to Aerosmith. And in that day, those were, I would call them my angry music. I mean, I listened, Pink Floyd was another one. I listened to that music because I was angry, because I wanted to get alone, because I was upset. I might have been hurting at my job, not just been angry. And I would throw weights, and I don't mean through the wall. I mean, I'd get on my weight bench, and I would just pump iron. Although, and my mom's here today, I did put my foot through a wall once that I had to fix at the house. So, I mean, I definitely had anger problems, had anger issues, and I would use that music to kind of bolster that. And so God got a hold of me and changed my story. And in part of changing my story was for me to take all of that music that at that time I listened to, and I put it in a box, and I went in the backyard, and I burned it. There was a lot of good music there, depending on what your definition of good music is. And depending on what, and seriously, on what your freedoms are. So that was a long time ago. Fast forward, God has given me freedom to be able to hear those songs, to hear those groups again, and it has not the same effect on me. I am not a prisoner of that anymore. That is my freedom. I'm not trying to put that on you. But what we also have here at Cornerstone is we have those of us here who have taken a freedom and they've borrowed it. You might not, for the sake of the example, but there are many more, you might not be in the same boat as me with the music. I can't put that on you, and at the same time, I can't look at you when you come to me, and there's assuming a lot of stuff here in what I'm about to say, is when you come to me and say, here's how I experience you as a leader at Cornerstone, here's how I experience the music you listen to, and this is how I respond. This is how it makes me feel. This is how it causes me to stumble. And we're probably not going to use those words, but in effect, that's what Scripture says, and that's what it is. And so there's two things that happen. And I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of myself. So where we are, legitimate freedoms. I have a legitimate freedom with this music. You might not. You might borrow that freedom from me because I'm somebody here who maybe is up front more than others, and you hear me more than you might hear others, and so you think, oh, because this guy who's up front at Cornerstone has his freedom, I'm going to take that freedom too, and I'm going to claim that for mine. Legitimate, borrowed. Then we have those of us who haven't experienced those freedoms at all. Those are the two camps, legitimate, borrowed, and maybe not having experienced those freedoms. And what we're doing as a family here, which is not God's economy for our family, is as somebody who's experienced that freedom, you come to me, so Tammy comes to me and says, you know what, I noticed when I came into the office this week you were listening to Metallica, which if this causes you to stumble, I have never done that. And Tammy says that to me. And I look at Tammy and I say, well, Tammy, God's freed me from that, so you just need freed, and you need to deal. And understand that as I look at Tammy, and I love Tammy, Tammy's my sister, you're probably not going to hear me say it like that, and you might not say it like that. You might not think it like that. But what you're saying is, deal with it. God's freed me. I'm free, man, woman. Deal. Then the person who might not have experienced that same freedom that I have looks at me and says, man, what are you thinking? Do you not understand the impact that this has? Whether it's on, for the sake of our example, Tammy and Tammy's heart and how it impacts her, or maybe on Tammy's son, or maybe on somebody here in Lebanon, or somebody sitting next to you right now. And instead, what we do is, and maybe you can identify with this, I am an older person, and I used to play Atari, this game called Pong. Use a little roller things. Boop, boop, doo, doo. Sound effects. The Judgment Pong is what I like to call it, and this was the picture that came to my mind, as we have this Judgment Pong going on, where, you know, with those who are, and this is a whole nother sermon, is those who have legitimate freedoms and those who are borrowing it, that's a whole nother, but we're not going to talk about that today. Those people who have those freedoms or use those freedoms, and those people who don't or haven't used those freedoms, haven't experienced those freedoms. The freedom camp judges the non-freedom camp saying, you just need a deal, man, and you're not going to tell me what to do. And the people who haven't experienced those freedoms looks at those who do and judges them, saying, do you not get what you're doing, you fool? And so we have choices, two of them, that are similar to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We either want to control, which God doesn't call us to do, or we want to flee, which God does not call us to do. That has already happened here at Cornerstone. People have fled, and people want to control. Neither one are what we're being called to do. There is a better truth. There's a picture in the Bible of the body. And what's really cool is you can all identify with it because you're all sitting with one right now. I have one. This is it. And you can see it better than I can. Isn't that interesting? You can see me better than I can see. Okay, better than I can see me. The picture that I see is of a thumb on the job site that's trying to hammer a nail in, and wham! The hammer hits the thumb. Think for a second. What's your body's natural response to that? Well, yeah. Ouch. I feel that in my toe. Zzz. Everywhere. And then I compensate. You know, in my case, I am somewhat ambidextrous. I would probably switch hands with the hammer and give that one a break, give the one with the thumb a break. Well, that's God's design, to accommodate one another, to help one another out, to feel with one another. But instead, our response is, you know, we have hurting members, and we might be the ones that have hurt them. It's true. And our response is, well, you foolish idiot. I can't believe you got in the way of the hammer. Man, well, you're just going to have to deal with it until you feel better. And neither one is what we are being called to do as the body. When it comes to art, and I will tell you, my perspective of art is not going to be your perspective of art. My perspective of the art that we have is creating. And something that has been spoken over Cornerstone from not inside Cornerstone is, Cornerstone, you are a birthing, creating church. Keep creating. I will tell you, when we look at the map and we have those scouts that are out front and the main body that's back here, I think as a body we're at a place where we have scouts and visionaries who have led. We have a main body that is not in the same place. And the caution that I'm going to speak this morning is, to try to be very clear, is we are in danger as a church of telling ourselves how to worship God. Okay, I'm going to give you an example I gave with the elders. Years ago, if I would have been in college and came to this church today and saw the banners waving, I would have freaked out. I would have been like, what is going on here? Do these people not understand that that is so distracting? And, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I would have said that. So I'm not even saying you. I'm saying I would have said that. Until God has grown me here at Cornerstone to understand that banners are biblical and that banners are a way we worship. We are creative people. I almost hesitate to say it again, and I know it's noon right now, and I know I talked to the worship team about giving us a chance to respond. I know our kids are going to be waiting for us. DJ, I'll ask you to come. Let's just close with the last song. You can bring your team up as I finish this thought. Yep, go ahead, come on up. Is, as a creating church, some of you will create with metal. Some of you will create with wood. Some of you create with words. Some of you create with fabric. Some of you create on the basketball court. Some of you create in the woods. Some of you create on a car. I mean, we are creative beings. Understand, this is not about coming against a camp. What this is about today's passage and answering a question that actually answers another question. Am I going to choose to love you? And the kind of love that is beyond not rubbing two corn cobs together on a Sunday. Because see, love actually calls us to get out of our seat and come together and maybe sit beside each other and maybe touch one another. It's to answer that question of, will I choose to love you? Will I choose to be obedient? Which answers the next question, is, will I choose to love God? Because that's what his truth says. Because in loving one another, we are loving him. And the encouragement you can take from that is, when we do this together, we are putting his name out there. And not as a church that is divided. There's enemy forces between. We need to come together. This is not about individuals here, people. But it is about individuals here. Will we choose to come together? And not just so that you love me and I love you, but that we're going to choose to obey God and we're going to love him. Because I'm going to say to you, you know what, Corey? I don't understand X. But you know what, Corey? I also know that God doesn't call me to understand X. Because in 1 Corinthians 13, it talks about that mirror and that we don't see everything. We're only a part. Corey's a puzzle piece, and I'm a puzzle piece. And when we come together and when we all come together, we have a bigger picture of Christ. But if we're just going to stay all the same puzzle pieces here and all the same puzzle pieces here, we can get fit together and we can see that picture. And we can see that picture. But until I'm willing to come to you and to say, I want to know you, I'm not going to see Jesus the way he wants to be seen. And that's what this is about.